So first of all, let me thank Alain for the kind invitation. So my talk will be divided in three parts. So first, I will briefly introduce the concept of London code RNA and antisense transcription. Then I will share with you approaches and data that we have accumulated a number of years on the presence of antisense and London code RNA transcript in genes associated to hereditary Parkinson's disease and or selectively expressed in dopaminergic neuron sustancia nigra. And in the remaining part of my talk, I will describe the identification and characterization of a London code RNA that is antisense to UCLHA1, and that actually is the representative member of a new functional class of London code RNA that activates translation in a transcript-specific manner. So all of you know that since the sequence of a human genome, now the post-genomic era, thanks to the work of two large consortia, one hand ENCODE, the Encyclopedia of DNA Elements, which aim was to identify all functional elements in the human genome, and on the other hand, of a phantom consortia, functional annotation mRNA, that actually aim to assign a functional annotation to every transcript in every tissue and time in a mouse and human, actually we now have a complete different understanding of a functional characterization of a mammalian genome. And first and foremost, we now know that together, in addition to 25,000 genes that encode for proteins, we have even more number of genes, higher number of genes, that actually does not encode for proteins, which are the so-called London code RNA. You know, the last estimate actually points to 45,000 different London code RNA transcripts in the human and mouse genome. On the other hand, now we also know that the majority of the genome is transcribed, specifically in time and space. And this is specifically due to the regulated expression of repetitive elements of a long and of short type. So it has been postulated that along evolution, particularly when we have an increase in heterogeneity of a cell type of a specific organism, we have a huge increase in number in London code RNA, suggesting that London code RNA regulated expression of heterotransposons are actually the major driver of evolution. So, but one of the most unexpected findings of this large genomic approach to transcriptomics has been the fact that almost all the genes in human and mouse genomes has a gene of the other filament. So the concept of antisense transcription. This has been, for the first time, analyzed at the genome-wide level in a paper from the Phantom Consortia, Katayama and collaborators, 2005 science paper, and then it's been, you know, now has been now proved through, you know, in humans and even in bacteria, by Tom Gingera's lab in Cold Spring Harbor. So the realization that we have an antisense gene for every single gene in our genome actually leads to the definition of what is a sense and an antisense pair. So two genes share the same genomic region, but are transcribed for the two filaments. And if we look at them, how they could be reciprocal organized, actually we can classify them according to three different groups. In one hand, they are tail-to-tail convergent. In the other hand, they are head-to-head divergent. So in the first group, they overlap at the 3' end. In the other group, they overlap at the 5' end. Or they can be fully overlapping, which one gene is completely contained within the other one. And you know, this is, and we can also have all the different types of combination according to having protein-coding genes that are antisense to protein-coding genes, London-coding RNA that are antisense to protein-coding genes, and London-coding RNA that are antisense to London-coding RNA. Okay? And this is actually the configuration that is that has you know, attracted more attention. This is not working. And in which you have a head-to-head divergent configuration in which in one filament you have a protein coding gene and the other filament you have a London coding RNA. And a lot of papers came out, you know, in study to understand how the London coding RNA actually is regulating protein gene expression. And we can now fairly say that every single, you know, key regulatory step of gene expression can be regulated by an antisense. You know, there are cases, for instance, in which antisense transcription actually is transcribing the promoter region of the same gene, and we know that the transcription factor combines or cannot bind a transcription factor binding site in the promoter region of a protein coding gene according to the presence of antisense transcript. And clearly, also, there are now an increasing number of cases in which anti-transcription is also involved in disease. As usual, first example came from thalassemia. So my laboratory is actually fully concerned in trying to address this fundamental question. Have non-encoding RNA antisense transcript any role in Parkinson's disease? And we approach this biological problem with two different approaches. On one hand, we look at antisense non-encoding RNA transcript associated to hereditary Parkinson's disease genes. On the other hand, we look at the same classes of transcript as expressed specifically in dopaminergic neurons. So, for both approaches, I just want to share with you a technology that now is present in many different variants, you know, cage, deep cage, nano cage, helicose cage, whatever, you know, many, many different types of variants and different applications. But at the crucial, you know, the crucial characteristic of a CAP analysis of gene expression case developed by Kanichi, Yashizaki, and Riken is the fact that in the presence of mRNA, you copy a cDNA that forms a cDNA, a first-strand cDNA-RNA duplex, and you isolate tags that correspond to the very first nucleotides of a transcript. Okay? So this tag is really a cDNA copy of the first nucleotides present in the messenger RNA. And then you sequence them massively. Then you get your bioinformatic data, and you map it back to the genome. And what's happened, for instance, is that if this is a random part of a genome, in which you have that the height of a bar is directly proportional to the number of tags that actually map in this sequence, okay, you can see here that there is a huge number of tags that actually maps here and that are completely mapping at the 5' end of the ESTs that are known transcribed for that region of the genome, in this case, calbilding. So what this means that tags from cage methods technology actually identify transcription star sites. Okay? And so you can do many different interesting things. For instance, here, Sanderling discovered that you can classify promoters according to the distribution of tags. You have very sharp promoters associated to Tatabox, or you have very broad promoter associated to CpG Island. Or you can look at alternative transcription star usage. And I think this is a crucial complexity in the transcriptome mammalian cells that, you know, that we overlooked. Look at this. This is a paper that we published in Genome Research some years ago, in which we did deep cage of different types of regions of the brain. And you can see here that you have of the very same gene, you know, different transcription star site usage in different regions of the brain. And to these you can find a corresponding ESTs. So let's look at what we found in using this technology as antisense transcript in hereditary Parkinson's disease associated genes. So first of all, you know, the most recent version of the Phantom Project is FASTMO5, in which they used cage technology, you know, on a tremendous and huge amount of tissues. Okay, look at here. You know, we are talking about 975. In the phase 1, 975 tissues in human and 399 different tissues in mouse, or samples in mouse. And this led to a publication in which we also were co-author in Nature last year. And the Phantom 5 cage actually takes advantage of a variant that is called helicose cage. But again, you produce capping, you produce tags at the 5' end, and then you sequence and you map. And what we did, we look at the distribution in all these tissues of the tags, okay, in the loci associated to Parkinson's disease, hereditary Parkinson's disease genes. And look at what we found, for instance, in alpha-synuclein. So this is the alpha-synuclein locus. These are, you know, the transcript for alpha-synuclein. You can see here the two alternative promoters that we all know are differentially used for alpha-synuclein. And here you can see on green antisense transcription. This is the tags, the map in libraries from brain and cerebellum. Okay, so this is the transcription of alpha-synuclein gene. But these in green are actually transcription star sites associated to antisense gene. And actually, only here you can already see that there is an antisense transcript 5' head-to-head divergent non-encoding RNA that maps at the 5' end of alpha-synuclein gene, and another one that actually is convergent in overlapping at the 3' end of, again, of alpha synuclein transcript. This is just to give you, you know, some example. So this is the sense, this is the two different transcription sites of alpha synuclein gene that goes in this direction, and these are transcripts that actually goes in the other direction. So there is a partially overlapping region, and these are the ESTs that are associated to these transcription sites. But having this data for more than 1,000 tissue, we can also know exactly where these transcription sites used, you know, how frequent and how high is the expression in that specific tissue. So we have a transcriptional map of transcription site usage of all the antisense transcripts in alpha-synuclein locus. And this is, for instance, we always validated this transcript, and this is what's happening at the 3' end. So this is the transcription stars, these are different transcription sites used in different tissue. For instance, you can see we always found a very interesting pattern of expression in blood, okay, for all antisense transcripts associated to DJ1, alpha synuclein, LRK2, and pink, etc. I want just to, these are all the antisense genes that we found associated to alpha synuclein locus. So you can see it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So it will be very interesting now to understand how these 7 antisense transcripts that colocalize in alpha synuclein locus actually are duplicated in the cases in which Parkinson's gene alpha synuclein is duplicated in some hereditary cases, actually modulate alpha synuclein expression. And this is true also for DJ1. And here you can see some antisense transcript for DJ1, again validated by RT-PCR, and this is also for LRK2, in which we have a huge antisense transcription at 5' end that corresponds to a head-to-head divergent non-encoding RNA for LRK2. It will be interesting again to see how this LRK2 antisense non-encoding RNA regulate PARK8 expression. Okay, but then we also study antisense transcription in all other genes involved in other hereditary disease, and this is just the map of a new antisense transcript that we identified, leading to a 12, we found 50 antisense transcription sites. 12 were annotated non-encoding RNA, 1 was annotated protein coding gene in parking, and there was 37 new transcripts we were actually cloning by deep race and characterized, sequencing and characterizing. Okay, let me go back to the second part of my talk. You know, all of you are familiar with the tyrosine hydroxylase, the antibodies that decorate dopaminergic neurons, soma, and dendrites in the mesencephalon mouse. And we resorted to, you know, laser capture microdissection to try to identify genes differentially expressed between A9 and A10 neurons in the substance in the mesencephalon mouse. And we, in order to do that, we resorted to a variation of the cage that is called nanocage, that has given us 3 advantages. First of all, allow us to start from tiny amounts of RNA. It can work on poly-A- and poly-A+ RNA. Many of these non-encoding RNA are poly-A-, and are in fixed tissue or partially degraded RNA. I don't want to go into the details, so we took advantage of transgenic mice with dopaminergic neurons with labeled GFP. We took advantage of laser capture microdissection to differentially purify A9 and A10 dopaminergic neurons, and when we apply nanocage on this part. Okay, I don't want to go into the details. This is just a general mapping of tags in the different in RefSeq gene, repetitive elements, non-coding RNA, intergenic regions. I want to say that 50% of tags are antisense to RefSeq genes, and this is just to give you how, if you compare A9 and A10 pattern of transcription star site usage, you can see that in a random sequence of a genome, you can find transcription star sites that are used in both cells in the sense in antisense manner, but also transcription star sites that are selectively used in one of the two. So, you know, by doing this approach, we have already published some work. One is that we discovered the expression alpha beta globin, alpha and beta chain of hemoglobin in dopaminergic neurons, particularly expressed in A9 dopaminergic cells. And also, we recently published a paper in which we found that dopaminergic neurons express a repertory of olfactory receptors. Actually, the very same full-length cDNA sequence of some selected olfactory receptor that you find also in olfactory epithelia. And actually, we deorphanized some of them, and we showed the carvon actually was able to trigger ectophysiological response in dopaminergic cells. And more recently, we just submitted a paper in which we show that dopaminergic neurons express a specific isoform of erythropoietin receptor. And this could be, have some interesting applications, you know, in the use of erythropoietin as therapeutics for PD. But this is just to tell you the first characterization of non-coding RNA expression, and by comparing non-coding RNA expression data with olfactory epithelial nanocage data, we found 76 London coding RNA that are actually selectively expressed in 9 neurons and 55 that are expressed in 18 neurons and additional 91 that are shared by the two. Now, by in situ hybridization, we have to validate this data and to see if, for instance, link RNA could be interesting candidates to look for subtypes of dopaminergic cells. But let's go a little bit better, more deeper in the characterization. One antisense London coding RNA. This is an antisense UCLH1 gene. Okay, so this is a classic head-to-head divergent sense antisense pair in which we have a sense protein coding gene and the antisense non-encoding RNA. I want just to point out that this is a 70 kilobase locus. The transcript is 2 kilobases. I want just to point out that the overlapping region, this is not in scale, is only of 73 nucleotides. And it involves the ATG of a UCLH1 transcript. So if you do laser capture microdissection on dopaminergic cells, you see that, that the antisense to UCLH1 actually is enriched in dopaminergic neurons. And then you confirm this by doing triple labeling experiments in which you, on the very same section, you look at tyrosine hydroxylase expression, and then you use two riboprobes for the sense and the antisense. As you can see here, the antisense, the sense transcript, the messenger RNA for UCLH1, is present in the cytoplasm of dopaminergic neurons, and the very same cell that is also expressed the antisense, but the antisense is nuclear restricted. We will see later that this is an important piece of information. Okay, we recently published a paper in which we show the antisense of UCLH1 is a component of a neuron-dependent dopaminergic gene network, and is down-regulated in neurochemical models of PD in vitro and in vivo. But what is, was more interesting for us is taking advantage, as I said, by Professor Perlman, MA9 in these cells that we received from very kindly from his lab. You know, that cells actually, that cell line actually express both sense and the antisense. So we clone the full length of the antisense, we transfect the antisense, and here you do real-time PCR to look at the transcript. The antisense is indeed transfected here, but has no effects on the RNA level of a sense gene. However, we then, by looking at the protein, we found out that actually the protein level is was increased from 2 to 4 times according to the replica of the experiment. So suggesting that the antisense expression was indeed able to increase UCLH1 protein level with no effect on RNA level of a sense gene. All right, and since this work is already published, I don't want to go into the details, but what I want to share with you is the fact that this biological activity is due to the presence of two domains. On one hand, the 73 nucleotides that is the overlapping region between the sense and the antisense that we called binding domain, and the inverted sign B2 element that is an embedded repetitive element. In inverted sign B2, there are 350,000 copies in the mouse genome. Some of them are not expressed. Some are expressed independently as independent and transcriptional unit, but others are embedded in London-coding RNA, okay? And we found that actually, if we delete these 173 nucleotides of these inverted sign B2 elements, the London-coding RNA of 2,000 nucleotides does not work any longer, okay? So, is there any physiological condition where antisense UCLH1 regulates UCLH1 protein synthesis? I want just to make a long story short. We showed that rapamycin, so inhibitor of mTOR activity, actually increases UCLH1 protein level, and this increase requires the expression of the antisense. When we knock down the expression of the antisense or its function, rapamycin is not any longer able to increase UCLH1 protein level. Let me just summarize a very large amount of data because it has been already published. Okay, we know that there is CAP-dependent translation going on in the cell, you know, and that this is possible because there is an assembly or initiation factor of translation, including the CAP binding protein, that assemble with the 40 subunits of the ribosome and the mRNA, and they start scanning for the CAP, the 5' UTR, until a strong ATG sequence is found, and then the other subunit of the ribosome is associated and translation starts. So this is possible because in the cell, you know, there is TOR that is active. It's active by phosphorylating for ABP1, that is an inhibitor of the CAP binding protein. In fact, when we inhibit mTOR, okay, by, for instance, pharmacologically, by anti-rapamycin, 4ABP1 becomes dephosphorylated and this binds and sequesters the CAP binding protein, IF4E, blocking CAP-dependent translation. So I just want to point out that this is not found only pharmacologically, but is actually the first cellular response to stress. When cells is under stress, block up dependent translation, start choosing the mRNA that is going to be translated and is our component of the anti-stress response. And this is happening, you know, we are in all these conditions. And in those conditions, what we know that some of the RNA are actually translated because they have a specific secondary structure in the 5' end. Okay, and these are called internal ribosomal entry site virus that does not need an active cap-binding protein. So what's happening in the case of antisense to UCLH1? What we have is that in growing condition, we have UCLH1 that is actually associated to a light polysome, so it's translated, but not very efficiently, okay? The mTOR is active and is keeping cap-dependent translation going on, and the antisense to UCLH1 is nuclear retained, as I show you in vivo, you know, in the section of the mesencephalon. However, when we treat cells with rapamycin, we block mTOR activity, we attenuate cap-dependent translation, and we trigger, you know, we have several experimental data on this, some of them are published, we trigger the shuttling of the antisense from the nucleus to the cytoplasm. And through the overlapping region, the antisense triggers the shifting to the heavy polysome of the mRNA fused H1. So in the presence of the antisense, the mRNA UCLH1 shift from light polysome to heavy polysome for an increased rate of translation. And this actually is responsible for the increased UCLH1 level that we see in our Western blot analysis. All right, so since then, what we testing this model, the first thing that we did actually was by looking at by different RNA-seq, helical cage, and small RNA, the type of RNA that shuttled from the nucleus to the cytoplasm upon rapamycin. And we found, you know, several differentially expressed genes in the cytoplasm upon rapamycin. And what was interesting, an important fraction of the cells, of genes that shuttle, actually are components of the same and the antisense of the very same gene, okay? In the same the very same sense antisense pair. And we are actually characterizing now what is the significance of this, and this is the base of a molecular mechanism. But what I want also to share with you is the fact that we ask ourselves if this is a characteristic only of the antisense H1, or is it a general characteristic shared by other now to the sense antisense pair. So we look bioinformatically and we search for sense antisense pair, in which sense is protein coding, they are 5' head-to-head divergent, and the antisense long encoding contain the overlapping region and an inverted SNB2 element of a very same type of antisense H1. And actually, we found 200 sense antisense pair, and this is just one example. We have now validated more than 10 of them, you know, in which we resorted to study a sense antisense pair that is expressing MN9D dopaminergic cells. We cloned the full length, we transfer the full length of the antisense, and again, no change in UCLH1 in UXT mRNA level, but increasing protein level. And so we decided to call this class of natural antisense non-encoding RNA synapse because through the activity of a sign element, they upregulate translation. But what is the embedded domain acting in human? Because SNB2 elements are not present in human genome, okay? So this is a very interesting aspect of studying repetitive elements in the evolution of genomes, because different types of repetitive elements have parasitized the genome in different species, playing a fundamental role in evolution. So we ask ourselves, are there any type of repetitive elements that can functionally rescue the activity of SNB2 elements in humans? And actually it's yes. And actually, we found it in collaboration with Piero Carnici, finding that a sense antisense pair of a human protein phosphatase 1 regulatory subunit 12A locus, in which we actually found that through the activity of embedded repetitive elements, actually we have this antisense is working exactly as the antisense H1 in mouse. But then we ask ourselves how the effector domain is working. What is the functional mechanism? What is the molecular mechanism of inverted SNB2 elements to activate translation? So you know that inverted SNB2 elements has a POL2 DNA binding site, a B box and A box that is involved in RNA POL3 transcription. And so we resorted to chemical footprinting in order to study the secondary structure of inverted SNB2 elements transcribed in vitro. And this is actually the results in which you know, this is the 5' end. So this is the structure in which it forms three different stem loops and four different internal loops. And then we deleted all different sequences in the structure, and we found out that by deleting selectively the very top 5' end, the very top end of this secondary structure, that is the stem loops, we can kill completely the activity. So, okay, so this is not trivial. You know, you have a long non-coding RNA of 2,000 nucleotides. You delete 9 nucleotides, and, you know, according to the structure that you identified, as it's not working any longer. So we resorted to NMR studies of a 38 ml of a stem loop structure in the vertex MB2 elements, and we found out that actually it's forming, you know, an A-type RNA helix, and then a pseudo loop at the very top that is formed GUG 3 loop and two highly unstable AU base pair. And then we did the molecular dynamic simulation. Here you can see here that this is actually the stem, and this is the pentaloop structure. Okay, and we are now better characterizing the presence of the functional significance of this stem pentaloop, because it's very, as you can imagine, it's very similar to a tRNA. So one fundamental aspect in finding out the mechanism is to try to look at the presence of or identify proteins that binds the RNA, and we resorted to a screening of ORF phage display library, and actually we screen this ORF library with different probes transcribed in vitro, and the major interactors actually resulted to be the double-strand RNA binding protein interleukin enhancer binding factor 3, and we have recently, 2 weeks ago, actually validating the interaction between IFE3 and the protein, and what is interesting, and the antisense UCLH1, and what is interesting here, that actually IFE3 is very well known to shuttle from the nucleus to the cytoplasm according to rapamycin treatment. Actually, we recapitulated this phenomenon in MN90 cells, and we are actually now characterizing the RNA interactum on IFE3 to show if IFE3 is indeed, you know, a fundamental molecular player in nucleus cytoplasmic shuttling of synapse. So let's go back to the concept of synapse. So this is delta 5' synapse. So it's a synapse with only the effector domain. But if the binding domain is the pairing is responsible for choosing the type of mRNA that must be translated, then we can, you know, modify that sequence. And for instance, you know, we, as a proof of principle, we created an artificial binding domain to GFP mRNA, proving that actually it was working as expected. That is, you know, if we transfected increasing amount of the synapse GFP, you know, no change in RNA level for GFP, but increasing GFP protein level. And this is actually can be complemented also by if we put the human repetitive elements that we found in PP1R112A. So the human repetitive element is able to complement in a synapse GFP the activity on vertex MB2 element. Okay? But then we can design, so synapse actually works in different cell types. Here there are some examples: HEC, HepG2, HeLa, we know now also keratinocytes, neuro2A, etc. And then we look at synthesizing different synthetic synapse for different targets. This is a synapse flag in which you can see here, you design a synapse flag and you have a fusion protein to a protein that we study in the lab, it's called TRAF6. As you can see here, if you co-transfect flag TRAF6 and the synapse against the flag, you see increase of a fused protein by an anti-flag antibody or an anti-TRAF6 antibody. On the other hand, we also synthesize synapse against secreted proteins. There are some natural synapse that are for secreted proteins. For instance, one is an antisense to elastin that actually works. We proved and we just submitted a paper work as a natural synapse. But also we design synthetic synapse to increase production of recombinant antibody, clearly to be, you know, for a potential protein manufacturing application. So now we ask ourselves, could we design synthetic synapse to increase the level of a target gene protein, you know, at will? And in order to understand, in particular, this could be a huge number of applications, you know, in molecular therapy. These are all the clinical trials, you know, they use small RNA as reagent and drugs, but you all know that these are all inhibitory. these are all antisense oligonucleotides of siRNA molecules. So none of these gene, none of these RNA actually able to increase the expression of your target. So in order to prove that, the first thing that we need was to create a mini synapse. So not using a 2KB transcript, but go back to go down to 246 just to start. This is just obtained by putting together the effector domain and the binding domain, only those two sequences. And now we are chopping the effector domain, and we know that binding domain can work as short as 32 nucleotides so far. So then, but the fundamental question is, are synthetic synapse able to increase endogenous protein level of genes that do not present a natural synapse? And so since we work in Parkinson's disease, we were interested in developing synapse for DJ1, and we created a synthetic synapse for DJ1. As you can see here, that by transfection with a synthetic synapse for DJ1, we are able to increase DJ1 protein level of 3-folds with no change in RNA level. But the most interesting application could be, you know, haploid sufficiency. All you know what are they. You know, they occur when a diploid organism has only a single functional copy of a gene, and the singular functional copy does not produce enough protein to maintain wild-type condition, leading to an abnormal or disease state. Synapse could be an important tool because, first of all, they act on a specific mRNA isoform. Second, there is no uncontrolled ectopic expression. You know, for those of you that work on transcription factors, know that if you overexpress 50-fold transcription factor, you have a lot of, you know, low specificity binding sites that are activated and a lot of specific effects. And the increase here is in physiological level. So we applied, we created synthetic synapse against, for instance, frataxin, for Friedreich ataxia, and here you can see a synapse for frataxin that actually is able to increase endogenous frataxin level 2.5-fold. But then we also, and right now we have an active collaboration with 11 laboratories worldwide for 14 haploid sufficiency, 20 target genes, and we have several positive results. I want to say that my major effort right now is to create synapse for the different isoforms of BDNF mRNA. Because you know the BDNF has one exon for a pyridine frame, but has 8 alternative 5' UTR with 8 alternative promoters. And you know, so you, if you can, you know, increase the translation of BDNF only in one specific isoform, then you will be much more selected in your activity. So let me just share with you in the last 5 minutes of my talk, you know, results from collaborative laboratories. This is Giuseppina Miano and Igby Naples that designed a synapse against KDAM5C, a lysine-specific demethylase that gives rise in haploid sufficiency and X-linked intellectual disability. And you can see here that actually synthetic synapses are able to increase endogenous KDAM5 protein level, both in two different cell lines, and are actually able also to rescue the function of the protein that, you know, so in demethylating targets that were previously methylating for the loss, for the low expression of a protein. And but most important, most interesting, we were very fascinated in trying to see if synapse can work also in non-mammalian chordates. It could be a reagent like morpholinos, okay? And so we collaborated with Brunella Franco at TGEM, and we designed synthetic synapse against different genes involving microphthalmia with skin lesions that have been modeled by Brunella Franco in medaka, okay, in fish. So this is a test of a phenotype in vivo in a fish by creating synthetic synapse. You know, I don't have time to go into the detailed experiments, but, you know, you can see here. So, you know, when you have a morpholino, you see a degeneration, basically a undeveloped eye. But if you do the morpholino plus the synapse, you have basically the rescue of a phenotype. And this has no effect on the level of a target RNA. So we have several proofs that this is due purely post-translational. We are now, you know, so this could suggest that we can create a library of synapses for specific mRNA target to study in vivo, you know, in medaka and perhaps also in Xenopus, etc., as for morpholino for knockdown genes. So synapse at the end could be used as experimental tools in the lab for biotechnological production, and we hope in the future for therapeutics. But let me just finish with what is my take-home message. Okay, when one talks about long non-coding RNA, probably has a misconception. The London coding RNA are linear, single sequence, unique sequence transcript. Indeed, 40% of the nucleotides that are present in a London coding RNA are embedded repetitive elements. This is important, because if you start thinking about that, and we can take advantage of the data that I just presented, we can now hypothesize a molecular function domain organization of London coding RNA, in which embedded repetitive elements are actually the functional domain, and through a repertory of RNA protein interaction of the different embedded repetitive elements, we can then tether a specific biochemical activity or cellular localization to a specific RNA target to mRNA-RNA interaction, or to a DNA, a specific genomic region to DNA-RNA interaction. And so let me just finish by thanking my collaborator, in particular Piero Cannici at RIKEN and Claudio Santoro at University of Eastern Piedmont in Italy, and my lab, in particular Silvia Zucchelli and Claudio Carriere. Thank you.